Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to hear Dr. Steve Rosen talk for us. I'll introduce our speaker briefly. He is head of the Washington Project of the Middle East Forum in Washington, D.C. For many years, he was policy director of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and he's held professorial positions at many universities, including Brandeis University, Pittsburgh University, and the Australian National University in Canberra. So he knows Australia well. And he's currently teaching at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. And Dr. Rosen's trip tonight has been made possible by the Australian-Israel Jewish Affairs Council, and thanks to Anthony Orkin and the team at the Australian-Israel Jewish Affairs Council for making our speaker possible to us tonight to address us on the topic of U.S.-Middle East relations, new administration, new relationship, question mark. Dr. Rosen, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. It's a bit daunting to know you're in a series in which Tony Abbott is the next person after you. But perhaps that's a little misleading. Next week, next Wednesday, 8 days from now, President Obama will land in Israel for the first time as president. He's at the beginning of his second term, as you know well. So is Prime Minister Netanyahu going to be at the beginning of his second term. Netanyahu is going to announce the shape of his new government either tomorrow or Wednesday of this week, very shortly. Actually, the answer is already publicly known. Excuse me, when any president of the United States travels abroad, it's quite a stunning visual. You know that when he travels to the Middle East, he not only comes on Air Force One, this gigantic 747, but they bring Air Force Two along. This is a true story. They bring an entire second 747 in case something goes wrong with the first one. And they bring not one but two presidential limousines on the plane because they don't trust these Middle Easterners. Probably a good decision. I'm not making any of this up. This is exactly what's going to happen. They send advance teams 2 months in advance, and then 2 weeks in advance, and so on. There are literally, without exaggeration, 1,000 American staff involved in the advance work for the President of the United States to go to the Middle East, dangerous part of the world. But that's not actually the interesting part. The interesting part, it's no secret, there has been a tense relationship between Barack Obama and the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. But I don't think tense relations are what you're going to see next Wednesday. Because on both sides, the situation has changed. And I want to spend just a few minutes with you about what has changed, what is different. The second Obama administration is not going to look entirely like the first. This was a president who came to the White House with very little foreign policy experience. You probably know the basic facts. He was a state legislator in the state of Illinois until only 2 years before he went into the White House. He was only served in the United States Senate, the federal Senate, where he had any foreign policy experience, for 2 short years before becoming president in January 2009. And when he, and in Illinois, he was a professor at the University of Illinois Law School, not exactly a world affairs specialist. So when he came to Washington in 2006 and joined the United States Senate, He had himself put on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee because he already had it in mind to run for the presidency. And he knew that he had to burnish his international credentials. But, and I say this with no disrespect, it's well known in the United States Senate that he never actually attended any Senate Foreign Relations Committee meetings. No, it's just a statistical fact. I'm not trying to make a moral judgment from it. But because he was quickly absorbed in the struggle for the Democratic presidential nomination. You may remember that the front runner was Hillary Clinton, and she was the heir to the Clinton dynasty, which is this huge political machine that raised more money than the world had ever seen up until then. And she was considered unbeatable. And he was determined to prove that wrong, and to his credit, he did prove it wrong. And in a mere 2 years, he rose from obscurity to defeating the Democratic frontrunner for the nomination of the Democratic Party, and then, in short order, defeating the Republican candidate, John McCain, and becoming the President of the United States, which is quite a stunning rise. But he did not actually have much foreign affairs experience when he landed in the White House. He's an exceptionally intelligent guy and a very quick study and has done a masterful job of learning on the job. But he did not start out as somebody who knew the world very well. So he came into the White House with some gut instincts of how to deal with the problems facing the United States and a lot of advice from his Democratic colleagues. Now, to understand the kind of advice he was getting from his Democratic colleagues, you have to take yourself back to 2008. And in 2008, the Republicans had been in the White House for 8 years, George W. Bush. And they had, among other things, fought the Iraq War, which Democrats unanimously thought was an enormous mistake. And they believed that the president had ignored the tools of diplomacy and that he, George Bush, and the Republican Party had an undue love for the use of force and little appreciation for diplomacy, especially multilateral diplomacy, working with the world community and using the tools of persuasion and communication and dialogue. So his perspective was that he was going to be a president who undid the damage that had been done by George W. Bush and brought us back to the promising diplomacy of the Clinton era that had preceded it, especially in the Middle East. And the Middle East had a special place in the worldview of Barack Obama because, as you're probably well aware, his family history was, although he was brought up by his white Christian grandparents, he also was the product of the two marriages of his mother, both of them to Muslim men. And he had spent some of his early growing up years in Indonesia, where he had fond memories of all kinds of decent people who were not the kind of people who were going to blow up the World Trade Towers and be terrorists. And so he felt that he had a rather unique personal calling to prevent the conflict of civilizations, the sort of Judeo-Christian West versus the Muslim peoples of the Middle East and much of the world to the east of the Middle East. And so he thought that he could play a transformative role in the world system and create a dialogue of civilizations instead of a conflict of civilizations. And that included, among others, relations with Iran. He agreed that it was not a good thing for these extremists in Iran to get nuclear weapons. By the way, he banished from the White House vocabulary the term Islamic extremism because he felt it was a racist term. And he was willing to talk about extremism, but not Islamic extremism. And But he felt that the Bush administration had mishandled, along with so many other things, our relations with Iran, and that an approach of dialogue and an outreach to the Iranians and an approach based in the diplomacy, especially multilateral diplomacy, working with others, might win over the Iranians where this confrontational approach had been so unsuccessful. So he announced during his presidential campaign his intention. And similarly, on the issue of the Palestinians, he didn't think the Palestinian-Israeli conflict was the source of all problems in the Middle East, but he thought it exacerbated all the other problems, and that most importantly, it was a solvable problem. And he remembered, and by the way, in this regard, it's not just him personally. I would say most Democrats believed in the year 2008 that if only there was presidential involvement and a president willing to roll up his sleeves and use the tools of diplomacy and play a leadership role, that a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was near at hand. The typical way that Democrats would express it in 2008 was, we were this close to an agreement under Bill Clinton, but George Bush threw it all away because he had a policy of benign neglect, and he neglected the Israeli-Palestinian problem, and I and we have to redress that and go back and roll up our sleeves and solve this thing because it causes so many of the other difficulties in the Middle East. So that was broadly the Barack Obama. I don't mean to paint a cartoon. I think it's a fairly accurate depiction of the Barack Obama of January 2009 when he had his first inaugural. But there was one more element, and that was the cheering. You really, it may be difficult here at the, I guess this is the most distant part of the globe. If you draw a pin from Washington, D.C. through the entire, I'm not making this up. If you draw, I live in Washington. You draw a pin through the entire globe from Washington, D.C. to the furthest point, it is Sydney, Australia. When you pay the round-the-world airfare, there are many round-the-world airfares, but if you stay in the Northern Hemisphere, your fare is only 50% of the fare of coming to Sydney. It is really a faraway place. You guys ought to blow this place loose of the Earth's crust and tow it to someplace convenient.
You like it here.
You like to be far, far away? That's what draws you all together? Okay, we're digressing. So, I lost my point.
You were talking about the isolation of us, Sydney, Australia, from Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Anyway, that was the worldview in January 2009. And he got to be it was the cheering. You may not realize, being so far away, that America had a magical moment. A magical moment that dwarfed the Kennedy years. There has never been a love affair between very large parts of the American people and the occupant of the White House quite equal to what we saw in January 2009. Millions of people came to Washington cheering their lungs out. And he was on the other end of that. It was an intoxicating experience. And he saw himself, and in fairness, many others encouraged him to see himself as a transformative figure who had the power through his extraordinary command of words, and he is one of the great speakers ever, to change the world and especially change the Middle East. Well, that's how it started. But 4 years passed. And that's not how the 4 years ended. Actually, a lot of bad things happened. He had thought, for example, that all that poll data about how much Muslims disliked America in all of these Islamic countries, and there are 50 of them in the Islamic Conference, was because of George Bush and the Iraq War and the Republicans and so on. But actually, with the advantage of 4 years of more data in what the polls put out by the Pew Charitable Trust, which is basically a Democratic organization, are that actually America's image among Muslims around the world today is even lower than its already abysmal place in 2009. They didn't fall in love. They're actually angrier than ever. And similarly, the Palestinians. You know that from 1989 until 2008, there was a steady stream of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. But since the day Barack Obama took office in the White House, the Palestinians have refused to negotiate with Israel. There have been no, I'm not exaggerating, Israeli-Palestinian negotiations for 4 years. Far from this transformation, this magical power, we have the first 4 years with zero Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. And meanwhile, lots of other bad things happened. There were protests in Tahrir Square, and the president, and in fairness, a lot of Republicans too, were convinced that these street protesters were some kind of democratic movement, and it was very romantic, and we were going to have a new Middle East. And instead, we got the monstrous situation that we have, and I don't know if you've been following what's going on in Egypt, but just this week there have been street protests all over again, but these street protests are demanding that the supreme command of the Egyptian armed forces take over and throw out the Muslim Brotherhood. This is astonishing. Street protests demanding a military coup to save them from this government. So it hasn't exactly been a wonderful thing. And as far as Iran is concerned, it was on Obama's watch that Iran doubled and doubled again and quadrupled again its production of enriched uranium, including enriched to the 20% level, which they never did before, and built a secret facility under a granite mountain called Ferdo, explicitly so that it couldn't be bombed, and became more and more defiant. Not to mention, began torturing people in Syria on a huge scale and all kinds. I mean, I won't even bother with the parade of horribles that one could list. So the outreach hasn't exactly been a glowing success. Well, Obama's an intelligent man, and he has taken account of all of this. Actually, early on, he gave a series of interviews as early as 2010. In which he began to tell journalists that he regretted having inflated expectations so much and thought that perhaps it actually harmed the situation. I might add that his new Secretary of State, John Kerry, to his credit, publicly expressed disagreement with some of the things that Obama was doing. For example, Kerry, while chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, expressed doubt that it was smart for Obama to focus so monolithically on the Israeli settlement issue. Although Kerry didn't like the settlements that much, he thought it was a mistake to make it the centerpiece because it was actually going to reduce the chance of progress rather than helping. So, now, I don't want to use up too much more time because it'd be much better if we had time for a discussion. But I think that the Barack Obama you're going to see get off the plane, aside from the hoopla with the limousines and so on, is a different President Obama. I think that he very much intends to try to reset the relationship with the re-elected government of Israel. And I want to digress for a moment about changes on the Israeli side. Israel had, from March 2009, most of the Obama years, from March 2009 until pretty much today, the most conservative government in its history, more conservative than the government that Menachem Begin headed, more conservative than the government Yitzhak Shamir headed. And it wasn't a perfect combination with a democratic liberal left government in Washington. And we had some well-known tensions. There is a second Netanyahu government in formation. It is still led by the right, but it's in partnership with the center-left, certainly not the far-left, but the center-left in Israel. And they something like 40% of the members of the new coalition, the new ruling coalition. Israel is a complicated country. You know, here in Australia, you have a complicated enough situation. But in Israel, they have seven so-called major political parties. digression. We have an organization in America called the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. And somebody once asked, why is it called the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations? And the answer is, there are no minor American Jewish organizations. So you have major political parties, and Israel has major political parties. But Israel has seven of them, and it's going to have an exceptionally complicated coalition. But broadly speaking, it's a coalition of the right and the center-left, as opposed to the far left. And I think the Obama team believes that they need to try to work with, rather than have an adversarial relationship with, the new Israeli administration. And I have been in close touch with the Israeli side, and I can tell you that the Israelis have a similar view. Barack Obama won the election. He's the President of the United States. He's going to be the President of the United States for four more years. Israel has a lot of very important issues that it faces. It very much needs its principal ally, the United States. And you're going to see a supreme effort by the Netanyahu team to work more closely with the Obama team. I could go on, but I think
that's enough.
How many minutes?
You've done 20, so you've got...
Chop here. I don't want to get cut off at the neck, you know.
You'll be fine. That's great. So we've got plenty of time for questions and discussion. So once again, thanks to the Australian-Israel Jewish Affairs Council for making Dr. Steve Rosen available to us this evening. So we'll come to questions and discussion. We've got plenty of time. Please don't stand up in front of the camera, because we like the team at Channel 648 on Austar and Foxtel, and don't upset them. So I may repeat some of the questions, because I want to make sure they're picked up in the microphone. So can I just start off? You spoke about a small disagreement between John Kerry and the President about settlements. Just on the issue of settlements, there is an argument, as you will be familiar with, as to whether Israel is able to defend itself on the 1967 borders. And if that's not capable of doing that, then there'll have to be some adjustments to the border if there is a settlement around East Jerusalem and beyond into the settlements on the West Bank. So to what extent could Israel go back to the 67 borders and still be a secure nation? Now, if you just come back here and talk to the back of the room. Yeah.
Well, look, the borders that existed were not lines that had some long history. What happened was there was a war between the two sides in 1948-49, and the 1949 armistice line was just a reflection of where the positions the armies of the two sides happened to hold at the moment the fighting stopped. And both sides, not one side, but both sides, insisted on wording of the armistice agreement that said, this is not a political line. And at no time did the Arab League or the Jordanians, who at that time were the ruling power on the other side, or any other Arab state or any European state, define that armistice line as a political border that had some moral or legal superiority to any other one. Jumping ahead all these years, that line has somehow magically been transformed in people's minds into some kind of a boundary with legal standing. It was not regarded that way. The line happens to be one that left most of the high ground in Arab hands and most of the flatlands in Jewish hands or Israeli hands. It's actually a transposition of the biblical situation. You know, in the time of the Old Testament, it was the Jews who lived in the hills of Judea and Samaria, and the Philistines, out of whose name the word Palestinian etymologically evolved, who lived in the flatlands of the plain of Sharon adjacent to the Mediterranean Sea. But the Jews were expelled from Palestine by the Emperor Constantine, and they lived in a so-called diaspora spread across the world, and they came back as a result of modern Zionism. And they settled in the flatlands, and the Palestinians ended up in the hills in a kind of historic reversal. But both historically and strategically, it's the hills that matter more than the flatlands. And I think that's your point, Jared. That said, in the search for political solutions, most of the diplomats in the world have focused on variations on the 67 borders. The 67 borders with land swaps, if you know the terminology. The 67 borders with adjustments. I am not here to argue for or against any particular solution. But I think it is a fact that it's the position of the Prime Minister of Israel. It's the position of the President of the Palestinian Authority. It's the position of the President of the United States. And I believe of most governments, all governments of Australia, that there ought to be some kind of territorial compromise. And there may, in fact, be efforts in this direction. My own prediction is you are going to see, and this may surprise you, an effort by the Netanyahu government to resume political negotiations with the Palestinians on the principle of a two-state solution, with efforts to define borders that are neither the borders of 1967 nor the borders of today, but a compromise line that the two sides can live with. And that would be my prediction.
There's a question down the back, and then we go over there, and then we go there. So, yep.
Approximately how many dollars each year does the United States provide to Israel by way of aid? Do you see the American taxpayers continuing that level into the future?
It's a question about the amount of U.S. aid to Israel, and do you see it continuing?
The United States no longer gives economic assistance to Israel because the Israeli economy has grown considerably and the country is largely self-reliant for its ordinary civilian needs. Israel, however, faces an exceptional defense burden because it has to maintain a military balance with a very wide coalition of neighboring states. And most Americans believe that Israel needs a margin of safety, that term of art is a qualitative military edge, the so-called QME, to enable the few to defend against the many, which most Americans consider to be in the American national interest. The United States provides something on the order of $3 billion a year, which is a lot of money. As a percentage, it's gone way down compared to the American budget and compared to the Israeli budget, but it is still a considerable sum. But I would add that actually it's the most popular, not the least popular, part of the United States foreign aid budget. It comprises about 20% of the foreign aid budget. Most of the foreign aid budget has very little support among the American people. They view it as a giveaway program, sinkhole, going to countries that have no real hope of using the money effectively. And actually, the most popular part of the foreign aid budget is the Israel part. And as a practical matter, the only thing that passes the foreign aid bill, I'm not speaking of the Israeli aid, I'm speaking of the other 80% each year, is the lobbying effort of Friends of Israel, who have a political constituency and actually carry the burden for all those other countries. So it's a paradox. It may seem odd to you, but the truth is that if the foreign aid budget were to be cut, the last thing cut in it would be the Israel component. Most of the rest would be cut first.
Dr. Lichter?
There's very little evidence that President Obama has supported reformers or moderates in the Middle East in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood. Do you think that there's any chance this will change in the second term?
Suggestion that President Obama has not supported moderates in the Middle East as distinct from the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, I would use the phrase supported sufficiently. I think never say never or none. because you'll be proven wrong. And there's lots of examples of the Obama administration supporting moderate Muslims in quite a few countries. You may say that they haven't done enough, including right now in Syria. But I wouldn't make the argument that they have not supported it at all. Again, never say never on none. It's a very bad debating technique.
So, Tom.
You made a little diminutive sign, like, so indicating that your various administrations were very close to consummating a peace in the Middle East.
What they remember to be the case.
My memories go back, you know, back to three successive presidents, the Secretary Baker, you can probably pinpoint the period before you were active. But it's surprising that a powerful nation like the United States, with successive attempts to negotiate peace in the Middle East between the Palestinians and the Israelis, have failed on so many occasions. The question then becomes, does the government, does the nation, the American nation, really have some sort of hidden desire not to
consummate a peace agreement? Okay, so there's a suggestion that because there has been a failure to consummate a peace agreement, that perhaps the American administration doesn't want to go there, right? Okay.
Well, first, I want to make it clear that I didn't say they were this close to an agreement. I was trying to describe the prevailing ideology of Democrats in the year 2008. Actually, this very day, the chief Israeli negotiator of the most left-wing party in Israel, called Meretz, his name is Yossi Beilon, and he's universally known as the leader of the Israeli peace camp. This very day, he wrote that it was a myth that we were this close. We were never that close. So I don't think we can hold Barack Obama accountable for the failure to come to a quick agreement here, because there were lots of problems that he didn't cause.
First of all, I'd like to throw in that Obama has already had the Peace Prize for his accomplishments in the future, which is very nice.
It was a kind of preemptive Nobel Prize.
Exactly. Yes. I think that's quite unique.
I was thinking of putting my name in for a number of prizes. For example, Best Pianist. I'm thinking of taking lessons.
But my point is I don't doubt that Bibi would love to make peace if he had a partner for peace, but I haven't seen any Palestinians ready to stand up and talk to him. And finally, I would like to ask, apropos the last question, how much does America donate to the Palestinians?
Well, your last question is different from what preceded. Look, I really don't think that Barack Obama caused or will cure all the problems in the world, and I think it's a great mistake to imagine that if only we had a different president, the slate would all be swept clean. I didn't mean to suggest that at all. But rather that this transformational vision was naive, and that he has been sobered by 4 years of experience in the real world, and the second Obama is different from the first Obama because he has his eyes wider open than before, is kind of my point. I really hope that in this glib way that I've been speaking, I didn't leave the impression that every one of these problems was caused by Obama. That would be very unfair and untrue. As far as the United States aid to the Palestinians is in the billions, and it has to be added to the United States aid to other Arab recipients. So it's not just the Palestinians. And it's in a, I don't have an aggregate figure for you, but it's in the billions, the many billions.
Hang on a second, we're stopping here. Can I just ask you, why do you think President Obama's had this change? Is it simply the lapse of 4 years, the start of a new term? Has he realized something he didn't realize before? Why do you think? He's changed. I mean, why would he have changed?
Because he's a highly intelligent man, and he can see for himself that far from getting a... I'll give you an example. Obama wrote several personal letters, handwritten letters, to Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran. He didn't even get the courtesy of an answer. They were very clearly spurned him, without even, you know, any kind of flourishes. So he's certainly not stupid. And he recognizes reality. And I think that he and the people around him have been sobered up by the the planet Earth and how things really work.
So we're going to go Duncan and Stuart, and then we're going to go down the back, and then we go here. Yeah.
You just mentioned Iran. I'd just like to hear what your predictions are as to the what's going to occur on that front.
Well, I have a controversial prediction. You know, that not just the Obama administration, but several American governments before them said we must never be left with a choice between an Iranian bomb and bombing Iran. And we are determined to find space for diplomacy and for creative solutions and so on. And this wasn't just Obama, it was the whole world. Well, the reality is that the clock is running out, and all of this effort has not produced a result, and in my own judgment is not going to produce a result. And we are going to be left with the naked, bare, dyadic choice that we did not want to have. Will Barack Obama do it? You know, one of the realities that's faced by an Israeli prime minister is that Israel's a remarkable country. Israel can do a lot of things, but it will never be a superpower. It's a small country. And relatively speaking, a small country with a limited number of aircraft that can even reach Iran, and a limited number of point of access. The Iranians know very well how the Israelis can get there. There are only one or two or three routes. And a limited number of weaponeering choices, and limited intelligence. The United States is a global power with far larger capabilities in any category you want to name. Between the United States Air Force and the United States Naval Aviation, for example, the number of aircraft that can reach Iran is many-fold greater than Israel. Their payloads are greater. Their weapon choices are greater. Their points of access are greater. The intelligence, sources of intelligence are greater. So the United States is vastly more capable of solving this problem than little Israel is. The question becomes a question not of capability, but of will. Little Israel has a very strong incentive to do it because it's very obvious what the Iranian intention is. The United States could try to learn to live with an Iranian nuclear weapon. There are some who say, hey, we're not happy about a Pakistani bomb and we live with that. We're not happy with a North Korean bomb and we live with that. Let's just live with an Iranian bomb. Barack Obama has repeatedly said, I do not have a policy of containment, meaning of living with an Iranian nuclear weapon. He said that, among other places, in September 2012 before the General Assembly of the UN Security Council. UN General Assembly. He has said it on many occasions. His vice president, Joe Biden, went to my former organization, it's called AIPAC, just last week and said, this president is not bluffing. Well, I would summarize it by saying there are no words that can be expressed by the human tongue stronger than the words that have been expressed by Barack Obama and his top officials to convince the world of his determination. But I would also say that the Iranians are not convinced of his determination. The Iranians really do not believe. I'll bet most people in this room do not believe that Barack Obama is actually going to do it. I'll bet if we went around the room and we asked, let's do it. How many people believe that Obama is ready to use the armed forces of the United States to prevent nuclear Iran? Well, me too, actually. But we're in a small minority in this room and in the world. And more important than any of us is the Iranians. They don't believe it. And thereby hangs the tale. So in the background briefings that the president's aides have been giving to the press about next week's visit to Israel, they've been saying that the number one purpose of this visit is not the Palestinians, it's Iran. It's a dialogue between the President of the United States, Prime Minister of Israel, about Iran. And why? Because American officials think that an Israeli strike could be the worst case, where you get few of the benefits and all of the costs. The United States will be blamed anyway, because people will assume there was an American green light. But the Israeli Air Force is sadly not capable of doing the job as thoroughly. that it would be far better that the United States do it. Also, the former defense minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, introduced the phrase zone of immunity. He said the Iranians will soon enter a zone of immunity, and that we have to act before they enter the zone of immunity. It's a good phrase, but the zone of immunity is different for Israel and the United States for the very reasons that I've laid out. Because of Israel's more limited capability, the Iranians will enter the zone of immunity at an earlier date. Because of the vastly greater capability of the United States, the date is later. But you're the Prime Minister of Israel. Can you trust the President of the United States? You've had this miserable relationship with Barack Obama. So I'll make you a prediction. The number one topic between in the Four Eyes meeting between these two individuals is going to be go something like the following, and I don't mean these to be the quotations, but the subtext. Trust me. How can I trust you? I trust me because I'm assuring you. I don't believe you. How can I believe you? That's going to be the conversation. That's what this visit is about.
Stuart, what interest has Israel got in giving up land when you have the Gaza experience? And secondly, the state within a state, what is the Israeli agenda in relation to Hezbollah?
Well, Israel faces an impossible dilemma. On the one hand, the evidence is clear that the so-called land for peace approach has not worked, especially the example you just gave, Gaza. Let me remind you, 2005, the biggest hawk in Israel's history, Ariel Sharon, is the Prime Minister of Israel. He surprises the Israeli people, he surprises the other side, he surprises the world, and he says, I'm going to pull out of Gaza. I'm going to pull out every soldier, every settler, every square inch, total, 100%. And he does it, and he says, and the army asks him, the Israeli army, the IDF, says, please don't give up the Philadelphia corridor, at least, this little strip between Gaza and the Egyptian Sinai. Give us a security zone, a barrier, a buffer. No, because I don't want to give them any excuse to continue the conflict against us, says Ariel Sharon. And he does it 100%, and then he goes into a coma. By the way, Ariel Sharon is still alive. He's in a coma today. If we would imagine, magically, him coming out of the coma, which is not going to happen, he would be astonished by what followed. Far from ending the conflict as he predicted, there are now thousands of rockets and missiles in Gaza. Just recently, there was a round of fighting in which Hamas, which has taken over Gaza in 2007, 2 years after he went into coma, 2 years after he withdrew, announces its intention to destroy Israel, no intention to negotiate under any circumstances, and boasts that it has fired rockets at Tel Aviv and Jerusalem from little Gaza. So the people of Israel, a majority of them would be willing, as a matter of principle, to agree to a two-state solution, but they're looking at the facts and they say, as you said, but then do a 180. What about the opposite problem? Okay, you can't sign any agreement with these people. They're hopeless, they're radical, they're extreme. They just want to see you dead. Are we going to fight a war after war every few months for the next 1,000 years? We're not going to go away. They're not going to go away. It would be much nicer to have as our neighbors the Australians, but they're not our neighbors. We have the neighbors we have. So I think what you'll find in the real Israel is an impossible dilemma. Neither the status quo nor the two-state solution has any real support. There are very few Israelis who will tell you that the situation we have today is so great. It's leading to global isolation. There's only so long the Europeans are going to be friends to Israel at all at the pace they're going. Even people like Merkel in Germany, Angela Merkel is a hero, is getting sick of it all, turning her back on Israel. Cameron in London. And even if you could magically form an alliance with the right wing in every country, look at the reality. Sarkozy's not the president of France anymore. Hollande, the socialist, is. Aznar is not the prime minister of Spain. Well, actually, you have a conservative government in Spain again, but you had the socialist for 8 years. You're going to get a socialist government from all appearances in London before too long. It's only so long the Tories will be able to hold out. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what the poll data says. So even if magically Israel could form an alliance with the right in country after country, the right will be gone from time to time at least. Obama's got a second term. He wasn't supposed to win, the Republicans thought. So basically, I'm sorry to say that X and its opposite both stink, and that there isn't a clean solution. Israel is a country that does not have the luxury of a good answer to the question, what do we do? All the answers are bad. And you have to somehow wend your way.
No, we're running out of time, and so we've all got to be brief. There's one in the middle, one down the back. Well, let's see if we can get to you later. No, so down the back, and then here, and up the back. Yeah.
Do you see in the Israelis a wider or larger actors in this peace process that we'll hope for, I guess, between Palestinians and the Israelis? And I mean major actors, I mean Britain, Russia, potentially China. Are there anyone seeing them as
Any wider actors might come into this, China or Russia, is the suggestion.
Well, most of them are troublemakers who just add to the difficulty. So I don't think in Israel you won't find a lot of enthusiasm for Russian intervention and Chinese intervention. No offense, but they're mostly have added to the difficulties.
In all of this between Israel and Iran, what about Iran's other Muslim neighbors? What about Saudi Arabia? What about Iraq? How are they?
Well, John Kerry just visited Saudi Arabia.
Where do they fit into this equation in terms of Iran becoming nuclear, and how will they affect it?
Right. You asked about Saudi Arabia and Iraq. I would put those in two different categories because Maliki has got a very close relationship to the Iranians, and they have succeeded in infiltrating the Iraqi. But in Saudi Arabia, in the United Arab Emirates, and in most of the Gulf states, you will find deep unhappiness that the United States has not acted more firmly to stop the Iranian nuclear program. As a matter of fact, John Kerry just got quite, the new U.S. Secretary of State just got quite an earful on his maiden voyage, his Getting to Know You tour of the Gulf states. Iraq is a special case because Maliki has got quite a debt to the Iranians and a hand in his government.
Beach, yeah.
Do you expect Syria to be on the agenda?
Well, yes.
So the question is about...
And if so, what do you expect? How do you expect the conversation
is Syria on the agenda, and what would that conversation be?
Well, Syria is a dilemma for Israel, and it's a dilemma for the Obama administration, because on the one hand, you don't want this upheaval to go on indefinitely. It's very dangerous. And on the other hand, arming the Syrian opposition is also dangerous. It's one of those no-good-choice situations. The problem with the Syrian opposition is that a large percentage of it is jihadist. And the arms may very well fall into hands that are even more hostile to the United States and to Israel than the Assad government. But going back to the former status quo is not an option either. There's an old principle of Israeli national security that Israel is actually better off with a strong central authority on its borders, somebody who can hold accountable, even if it's a hateful enemy, but somebody who has control. And you can get to them by their interests, however heinous their motives may be. And in a strange way, I think Israelis would have been happier if Assad was still there, but they don't get that choice because he's not coming back. So it's a dilemma, and I think there will be a dialogue about how to handle it. I doubt that either side of this conversation has a really clean answer to the question.
If the United States were to intervene, I presume, and bomb or something, attack Iran, wouldn't that be less dangerous than letting Iran go ahead and send a nuclear bomb to Israel, and Israel first sends one back? Do you think Iran would really set off a bomb? Would it be cheaper just to stop them in case they might?
Well, if Iran were to go nuclear, it would have a host of problems, not just the issue of a direct attack. But a nuclear Iran would be quickly followed by a nuclear Saudi Arabia. You know that Pakistan is a desperately poor country which has the capability to make and sell fissionable materials to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi sovereign wealth fund is many, many times bigger than the entire Pakistani economy. And the Saudis have told the Obama administration, it came out in leaked documents from the so-called WikiLeaks, that if they allow Iran to go nuclear, that they're going to have to go nuclear. And the same is true of Iraq, and the same is true of Turkey, and the same is true of Egypt. So a nuclear Iran will be quickly followed by a collapse of the so-called nuclear nonproliferation regime. And that will sooner or later lead to nuclear weapons falling in the hands of non-state actors like Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah. And you are going to start to see, you know, even the use of radiological weapons. If you take fissionable material and you wrap around it, or wrap it around a conventional explosive, ordinary TNT, and you stick it in the middle of Sydney, and you explode it and spread radiation everywhere. This is not a nuclear explosion. This is a conventional explosion, just spreading radiation. You'll depopulate the city of Sydney and the city of Washington, where I live, and the city of New York. So we're speaking of a very grave scenario here, and I think that Obama has made the right choice that we cannot live with. My own prediction is that, as I said before, Obama's going to surprise people.
Second last question, Craig.
It's all been very sobering tonight. I'm just wondering if there's any good news you can provide us on.
Well, there is good news. Let me give you an example. The Arab League today, we used to use the phrase Arab League as a synonym for the most radical forces in the Middle East. Actually, today's Arab League is a moderating force. The ones who used to hold it back, who were the so-called leaders of the rejectionist front, was Assad. Today, nobody in the Arab League has any care at all for what he has to say. So, this, I don't want to sound like Pollyanna, but the Arab League today is a moderating force. Another hopeful sign is, I don't want to offend anybody, but Mahmoud Abbas, the Abu Mazen, the head of the Palestinian Authority. This is basically the moderate team, is still in control of the Palestinian Authority. And we still have an opportunity to try to craft some kind of solution working with. Perfect, they're not. But better than the alternatives, they definitely are. So I could go on with a list. I don't think its situation is without hope. I'll give you another fundamental fact. Israel is the strongest power in a 2,000-mile radius. That's good news to me. And the Western alliance is strong, and Western economies, with whatever problems they have, are still dominating the world. I think there are lots of good news. I say that from the heart. I've been concentrating on troubling things, it's true. But that's because I'm a guest of the Sydney Institute.
Right.
He wouldn't have invited me here. He's already threatened to cut me down a notch.
No, we do trouble here. That's what we do. But, a final question. Don't go away.
Okay.
Speaking as an American, Secretary of State is now John Kerry. It might have been Ambassador Rusk, but she's still at the United Nations. So you've got Secretary of State Kerry, Ambassador Rusk, the president, obviously, is probably the three key players, and there are others. I mean, how do you feel about that team? Do you think it's going to be, apart from the president changing, will the team around the president change very much?
Look, I'm pro-Israel. John Kerry didn't have a 99% voting record on Israel, or a 98% in all the years he was in the Senate. He had 100%. I don't mean 99.5. I mean 100. And I have a high regard for John Kerry. So I think, look, you have to work with the hand you're dealt. And I try to live my life as a realist. Could I imagine things being better? Absolutely. I did not vote for Barack Obama. I would have rather somebody else won the election. But I don't think it's the devil in the White House, and I think we have to work with what is. He will be the president for 4 more years, and let's take that as our starting point.
Many thanks. Just stand aside for 1 second. I'll be very brief. Many thanks to Dr. Steve Rosen for a a stimulating talk tonight across a wide range of issues. It had its dark side, but thanks to Craig's question, it also had its light side. But I think above all, it was a realistic assessment, and that's what we're on about. So we're very pleased you can come and speak for us tonight. Your talk will be on our podcast tomorrow, be televised in due course, and be published in the Sydney papers online when Anne gets a paper from you. So many thanks for tonight, and we'll hope to have you back sometime in the future. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.